So that was a super fun discussion with Lean Kawas from Propel Biopartners.
Yeah, I really loved her insights into building diverse teams. And she has kind of done it all. So she was an academic, and then she founded a company, had a successful exit, and now she has founded this fund. And if you listen to one of our earlier episodes, Stephanie from Persephone Biosciences is one of the people who has benefited from her fund.
Lean just has such a interesting and fresh perspective on so many things, including the FDA. There's a lot of good information in this episode, and we hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to Building Biotechs, a podcast by Recruitomics Consulting. We've helped over 75 biotech, life science, and venture capital firms strategize, hire, and retain thousands of employees to scale companies that bring life-saving drugs to patients.
We speak with those at the forefront of growing biotechs to learn their tactics on building these companies from the ground floor to the C-suite.
We're your hosts, Karina and Allison.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. We are so excited to chat with you. And we're going to start it off the way we start off every show, which is asking, what did you want to be when you were seven? What are you now? And how in the world did you get there?
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show. I'm looking forward to it to have a dynamic conversation. So when I was seven, I wanted to cure cancer. And because my grandmother at that point passed away from cancer, and there wasn't a lot of options for patients with cancer. So I remember my dad was driving us to school, and I was trying to understand why did she pass away. And basically his response, we still don't have treatments for cancer. And I said, I want to cure cancer. And he laughed at that point because it wasn't like the science was not as mature as it is today. I actually ended up in drug development, exactly where I wanted. I studied pharmacy in Jordan and then moved to the US. I got my PhD and then worked as a researcher and then started my first company, Athera, to get funded. When I exited, I founded a fund with Richard Kane, one of the bigger investors that I had in my company. Now I work with a large number of companies that are developing therapies, whether it's for cancer, neurological indication, orphan indication, pediatric indication. So we get exposed to a lot of technologies, a lot of companies, and I'm on multiple boards right now. So it's amazing where I started and where I am today. The second part of your question, how did I do it? I just working hard and not fully understanding what I'm getting myself into at the start a lot of the time. And one thing that I have to highlight is we do have something very unique here in the US, which is the entrepreneurial mindset. People are raised to build, which is something very amazing. And it's very unique to the US. You know, people start looking at the country with an immigrant lens and appreciate how amazing this country and the opportunities that we are given to build and deliver technologies that can have a big impact on humanity.
That's really interesting. I don't think that anyone's ever said that before. And I guess we don't think about it on a day-to-day basis. You had a couple of major changes here. You went from an academic, you then founded a company, you had a successful exit, which is amazing. And now you run a fund. Those are very different things, and you've been wildly successful in each one of those areas. I'm just curious, how did those things differ and how did one lead on to the next? How did you end up going from a founder into this fund instead of just joining another company or starting another company?
Yeah, that's a great question. My first transition was when I was a pharmacist. I worked in a clinical setup and a retail, and then I said I wanted to recognize my dream and work on the research side. And the point that I mentioned, the cultural thing, when I came to the US, I had the, this is what I'm going to do. This is when I'm going to find a stable job, have children, because this is the mindset outside of the US. And then I got the opportunity to build a company. And when I first was introduced to the idea of co-founding a company, I didn't fully understand what it means. But you work hard, you put your heart and soul into something, you build it. And when I left the company, Rick Gabe was the other partner on the fund. Very successful investor and businessman here in Los Angeles asked me, what's your next move? I said, I have an idea of my next company. And he's, no, we're going to start a fund together. And I was like, no, I'm an operator. What do you mean? I'm not going to start a fund. And he said, let's meet at the end of the meeting. I'm either investing in your company or we're starting a fund together. And one thing that he mentioned is not a lot of people are successful from being a single person, idea, going out, raising capital, taking a company for later. I had a lot of things, I would say, that were unique. But one, I don't want to say against me. Still, being a woman, minority, things that are not impossible, but definitely harder. So he mentioned that he can help others build companies, and building a company is a complex thing. And when he said that, it resonated with me because I had other people help me and to help me to get what I got. That could be in that position where I could be value add, not for one company, but for multiple companies within our.
Tell us a little bit about what your day-to-day looks like. I'm sure every day is different, but I'm really intrigued. Like when you go to work in the morning, what are you typically doing?
I'm also a mother of two. So that's like a two-year-old and a six-year-old. So that adds to the madness. But it's lovely, right? Because every day is very different. We do a lot of research. We interact with a lot of companies, board meeting, reviewing businesses, meeting a lot of interesting people around the world. That's the beautiful thing. Today I had a call with a person that has a business in India. On Monday, I'm talking with a person who has a business in the Middle East. And it's just like also this exposure to recognize the similarities, but also the differences between the different cultures, which is nice because you bring differences. I always say diversity with experience and opinion in any company, in any day-to-day, allows the human and the organization to grow. So that's one of the things that I appreciate about my day-to-day, the diversity of my day-to-day and the diversity of the people that I work with.
And do you work with companies globally or are you mostly US-based with your fund?
I would say majority are US-based. We have some in Europe, but we're looking for talent globally. But I'm mostly in the US. There's time zone conveniences and still the US is the frontier in advances in technologies and innovations in the healthcare industry.
And are your companies based in one single type of therapeutic indication? But we spoke with Stephanie from Persephone a couple of weeks ago for the show. And what a fascinating company. Can you speak to the general theme around the companies you're supporting in the fund?
In general, it's healthcare and life sciences. We do have a focus on orphan indications, neurology, oncology, GI and metabolic indications, the immunology, some autoimmune indication. Persephone is one of the great companies, I would say. And when we looked at Persephone, there were two things that was very exciting about the company. One, the technology and the innovative way that they're using AI to identify probiotics, whether it's commercial or ultimately long-term therapeutics that will have a significantly differentiated product profile. And the second part is the team. Stephanie and she built a great team where I think that Stephanie will end up being very successful because she has the recipe of being a successful entrepreneur, perseverant, not accepting a no. She doesn't hear no. She just hears, I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to find a way. So this is people also. We look for people that we enjoy working with. Of course, believe in their skills because it's not just that idea. It's the ability to execute on the idea and fun people and people where the vision and also human side is very important.
Are there specific things you've learned along the way that you think are really valuable when people are at the point of bringing other people onto their teams?
Yeah, 100%. And done some things right. I've done some mistakes. And I think for me, when I look to build a team, especially after, you know, having a hands-on experience and now as I'm working with multiple companies, first of all, the mindset. Two things that I look for. One is someone who's always looking to grow, regardless of their stage and their career, and someone who endorses a beginner's mindset. And when I say a lot of people, beginner's mindset means, oh, they don't have experience. Actually, someone can have extreme decades of experience, but they still endorse a beginner's mindset, which means that I don't approach all problems in the same way because each problem has its own unique aspect. And you don't want to use the same mindset that led into the problem to solve the problem. So I appreciate people who are innovative and they look to learn from everyone. That's the thing. When you hire someone that is starting their career, they bring a very unique and fresh perspective. And this is as valuable as someone who's been doing the same thing or is working in the industry for 20 years, right? And how can you balance that and bring the best of the talent? That's very important. And diversity in opinion is very important. And giving a platform where people feel heard. And it's not just, oh, we talk, we high five, it's a fun environment. It's actually showing that you're listening and there's change as an outcome of people's involvement, because it gives them ownership. Okay, we actually change this thing because of what I said in the last meeting. They become owners of this idea. They become owners of this change, and they do everything they can to make it successful. This is the good side, but I made some mistakes. I'm happy to also highlight some of them.
Yeah, sure. We'd love to hear those. You learned so much from the mistakes.
Exactly. I think also follow your gut feeling. Don't feel pressured that you need to hire people that will complement the image that investors are. That's the one thing that I think is very important, especially for first-time entrepreneurs and women specifically. Don't feel pressured that you have to hire to satisfy intangible imagination of investors. The world is changing and we are part of the change. I was hired people that they were not a good fit, but, you know, they could talk football, they could talk golf, instead of me sharing, you know, interesting things about my background. I think it's important sometimes for investors to relate to you, but there are ways that you can relate to investors. And I also didn't fire it fast. That's the other thing. I tell everyone, hire slowly, especially in an important position in the company. Date the co-founder. When I look for a co-founder or another executive, date as much as you could. Don't feel pressured that you need to hire. And if it's not working, fire fast.
Yeah, I think the fire fast one is such good advice, but it is so hard for people to enact, because I think inherently most people want everyone around them to succeed. And you keep trying to maybe fit the square peg into the round hole. And then eventually it doesn't work. But by then, everyone's frustrated. Typically, even the person who isn't the right fit, I think they've realized, and it's difficult. Things get harder at that point. So I think that's really valuable.
If it's not the right environment for this person, you're not doing them any good. But also the rest of the team, right? But if there's specific things that you hold and it's this person is not fitting, whether it's the culture, whether it's like the way that they produce that work, it will impact the rest of the team. So that's the other thing. And it impacts you and it tells and creates all of this wasted energy. I think this comes with maturity and openness within the organization and environment as well. But also this comes with giving very clear feedback. You know, I always felt that I needed to quote harsh feedback. Now I just give very clear, straight feedback. And to my surprise, people were always like, we really appreciate how clear your feedback. Versus before, it creates that like difficult conversation and nobody feels good about it. It's a growth journey. I'm sure 5 years from now, I'm going to look back and there are some mistakes that I've done, but it's at least acknowledging and using it as an opportunity to grow and learn.
Yeah, that's very true. There's always learning that we can take away. I want to circle back on something you said a few moments ago. You were talking about not hiring to fit the mold of the person that maybe the VCs, you think the VCs will expect or want you to hire. And I want to highlight that because this is actually something we hear a lot within our work in terms of hiring people. And it's something that we try to educate, you know, against doing, is hiring for a certain background because you think that's the background that people are going to want to see or that will be successful. And it leads to maybe a lack of diversity because we're hiring all of the same people who have gone to the same schools and done the same thing. So tell us a little bit about this changing landscape that you're seeing in the funds, in the VC world, and how we can take advantage of that to start to spread diversity or figure out how we can hire people that are going to bring that diversity of thought and background.
I'm just being conscious about it. And that's the other reason why I wanted to be on the investment side, because I'm more aware. Even I have biases, right? And I'm like, one of the people that I hired is like, you're so big about inclusion and all of that stuff. Is it, how do you actually apply it? I'm like, sometimes I fall into that, right? Like I said, I'm actually not biased because of my experience. So I verbalize it in front of the team. And we try to make sure that it's not impacting our decision. There are actually several studies that have been conducted to show return on investment and health of companies with diversified team, specifically like in general, diversified team. And there are some studies specifically around women-led companies or management team that have. There's higher returns. Don't we all want to do better as investment firms? So I think like educating people about these statistics that there is significantly higher returns when you are intentional around investment in diversity. That is one thing that investors should be focused on. And the second part is in our industry, specifically clinical trials, when you're testing for products, whether it's therapies or devices, you're running clinical trials on the society or the humans, which we are diverse. The one thing about diseases is they don't discriminate, right? We all get. And now the NIH and FDA are very conscientious about we want representation of a diversified patient population in the clinical trials to be able to make informed decision how it impacts everyone in our society. And I remember another unique thing that me and my partner, well, we always focus on is patient involvement in the clinical development and drug development. And I remember this is one of the things, like 7 or 8 years ago, we've done a session with patients, Alzheimer's patients, and we wanted to hear from them. Alzheimer's patients is a tough disease. There's a lot of drugs that fail. And one of the things that I think happens is the way that clinical trials are conducted and the controls and the patient commitment to the trial. So we wanted to include the patient voice in our clinical trials and design to improve the outcome. I remember a Black woman who was early stage Alzheimer's. She said, I would never go into a clinical trial, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, surprised, yeah. I was like, so what can you explain to me? She didn't know I was the CEO of the company at that point. She's like, because every company I go to, I look at the management team, nobody looked like it. So why should I trust? This is very powerful. If we want our clinical trials to be more successful, as companies to be more successful, to recruit the right patient population, we need diversity in our management teams, not only in the people who are on the ground, because obviously, it is important. So I think we need to understand these things and be more vocal about it, that there is clear, enhanced return on investment when you're consciously intentional around diversity. And also, it improves the quality of your programs and clinical trials and operation. And you ultimately lead to products that have wider access and benefit to humanity.
That's a really powerful story. I've heard stories like that, but more in a survey of people who declined to participate in clinical trials said. So to hear that directly from somebody, and we know that historically clinical trials have been mismanaged, and we know that, and we have to come back from that. And I think it is leading from the top would be really helpful and powerful for the patients to see.
And that specific why I was so impactful when I heard her say that, because there's a higher number of women who, it's 1 in 3 women will develop Alzheimer's after 80. And then the other thing is Black Americans, they have a higher percentage of people who develop Alzheimer's as well. So this is like one of the main or very important demographics that don't feel safe going to clinical trials because of the lack of representation within the management.
That's a stunning statistic. I did not know that. 1 in 3. That is horrifying. Horrifying. It's one of my biggest fears. I am not afraid of getting old personally. I'm afraid of losing my ability to think because I really value that. I really love doing work. I don't see retiring. I see slowing down a little bit, but that's a big fear. So I hope we get that solved.
We will. I think we will. And the interesting thing, there's a lot of companies that are women-led now that in the Alzheimer's. It's an exciting moment, I think, for biotech, healthcare, Alzheimer's, and diversity, being intentional. It's still not like, you know, that we have a long way, but I think that there is increased awareness and intentionality and these types of conversation spread awareness. We all want to do better. We all want to do better health-wise, achieve our mission by having a significant impact on humanity and ultimately, you know, have significant returns on our investment as well.
We can do all those things.
I'd love to touch on Propel a little bit in the economic environment that we're seeing now. How long has Propel been in business?
It's almost 2 years.
Okay. Oh, 2 years. Okay. So you really started at like quite a dicey time. We talked to a lot of founders and early stage biotech CEOs, and it's been tough, right? It's a really tough environment right now. It's been really challenging. We're coming off of the pandemic was a pinnacle of cash flowing into the system. And now we're seeing a real reversal of that. As someone who is running a fund, what do you see and how are you like working with people to get through this challenging financial environment that we're seeing?
think that when things are tough, it's when real opportunities come up. You know, a lot of people are like, time, knowing we've been very fortunate with the fundraising and the capital. So from a fund point of view, you're able to circulate it very quickly. But their deployment of capital and finding their management team that will be able to survive this, because it took longer than anyone, right? Everyone was saying, oh, 2023, things are going to look up. Last week, they were saying, everyone's saying, okay, like 2024 is looking up. And you know, you never know, because there's a lot of things that are happening. But I think for us, and I tell this to the team, they're in the same mindset. If you are investing in product that we believe will have impact on patients, on people who are impacted by disease, the financial return will follow. And the second part, it will separate, right? If you support a drug, for example, one of the companies we are investing in is the Plaid Therapeutics. And this is a company that has a drug that potentially will get approved for galactosemia for patients, orphan indication in children. If this drug gets approved, it will have a big impact on this patient population. I'm confident there's going to be financial return, right? The CEO is a woman. I bring it up because it's a woman. And for some reason, women CEOs know how to manage their runway better in their brain. They don't run extravagant budgets. So they've been doing well in this environment. But it's also management. When we're looking at management, are they going to be able to manage cash? Are they going to be able to run the business and pivot in ways that will allow them to survive this tough period? And so far, Stephanie is one of them. Shoshana is one of them. And they're like, they've been consistent. There's consistency also in the ability to deliver and head to my talk.
Hey there, just a quick break. I wanted to let you know that if you're listening to this podcast because you are exploring careers in biotech, which it turns out quite a few of our listeners actually are, you might be interested in the Biotech Career Coach podcast. It is brought to you by our sister company, the Collaboratory Career Hub, which is our career development community. If you would like actionable tips on job seeking and career development, that is the place for you. It is a companion podcast to our Career Coach column that we write monthly in Biospace, but we go a little more in depth and sometimes we have special workshops and all of that good stuff. So if that sounds interesting, click the link in the show notes or search for Biotech Career Coach on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Back to the show. What makes you confident in someone's ability or like a company's ability to have good management and to manage their financials? Is there something that you specifically look for that's either a red flag or a green flag, or is it a culmination of many things?
You're dating the company, right? Before you invest in, you're meeting with the company, you're looking how they are doing, you look at their budgets. What I look for, and of course, this is the continued optimized process, but what I look for is someone who understands the business, all areas. You cannot be a CEO of a biotech company that is especially small. We invest in smaller biotech companies, later stage assets, but smaller. We don't invest in Lilly or Pfizer. It's really the companies that need help and capital and beyond. If the CEO is not aware of the details of the next stage and it's not controlling the detail, but you have to have a good understanding of the business to have effective communication with your team. So like we look into that. The second part is when we are in a Zoom call, most of the meetings right now is in a Zoom call. It's also important for us to see how the CEO is interacting with their team, because if they're interrupting or they're answering all of the questions, or they're not setting the stage, if you don't see that there is empowerment on the team on the call by the CEO and understand for them to, if I ask a question and nobody's there, I don't want them to like to call five people to figure out the answer. That's also important. So the dynamics between the team is very important. Thirdly is how they take feedback. When we have a dialogue, if they're so stuck in the way and they're not looking to be innovative in the way that they think in the interactions with the FDA. I think anyone who's outside of the industry, or even people who's been in the industry for 30 years, their direct reaction towards the FDA, very rigid, very hard to make changes with the FDA. So they go into this like safe path with the FDA. And when you go and meet people with you in the FDA, we are looking for innovation. We, especially in Alzheimer's, and they were like, everything that we were proposing to them, as long as it's scientifically logical, that there's no impact on the safety of the patients and that it gives confidence and that the drug works. as long as you're achieving these things, there is no like walks that they're trying to prevent us to there. So also like how they are approaching their product development, because each product is different. So the innovation and their willingness to hear other voices, whether it's from us or from the other team members. So how they receive feedback is very important. And their organizational skill and follow up and all of that. It's very important when we look at the management.
That's really actionable. That's really solid advice. And it mirrors a lot of we think about how we find clients that we want to work with and partner with in some of the same way. I wish we got to observe the interactions more, because that is so telling. That is a missing piece for us, is to be able to see the teams interacting with each other and seeing that dynamic, because that cultural environment of the give and the take and the letting people have ownership, that's really valuable and beautiful.
And I tell people, when you are hiring someone, don't just ask for references for people that they work with or reported. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you're asking for someone that they manage or they were working with, just because that is very telling as well.
100%. Yeah. Our trifecta for references is a manager, a peer, and a direct report, if applicable.
If applicable, exactly.
Yeah. It feels like that gives you a nice 360 review of the person. So we're wondering about communication within companies. And we talk a lot about good communication, but can you tell us a little bit about how you've managed conflict, both in the teams that you've managed personally, and then also when you hear about things? I'm sure you hear about things in some of these companies in your fund. How do you advise those founders?
Yeah, this is one thing that I'm actually really, I tell people, don't turn away from conflict. Use it as a way that you can build a relationship. And as long as there's respect and understanding that the goal is mutual, right? A lot of people, they want to win an argument, or I tell everyone, what we want to achieve as a team is getting to the right heads, okay? So conflict, if it's pivoted into a healthy and dynamic, heated discussion, can one, improve the team relationship, trust. And then the second part is we get to the right heads. So that's one thing that, when I have a heated discussion with someone, I remind them that this is because we got to that point where our trust is elevated. And how we recover from a heated discussion is what's important, right? And trust, transparency, honesty, and most importantly, respect is very important. And as a leader, to always remind everyone that our goal is mutual. So let's listen to each other and appreciate the different point of view rather than resist it, which is another thing where this kind of highlights the importance of a growth mindset. Because if you have a growth mindset, you're comfortable with conflict, and you're comfortable with, how can I tease out the benefit from this conflict?
You know what that reminds me of? I heard a really influential person recently say, nobody ever wins an argument. There is no winning an argument, because if you've won an argument, we've squashed somebody else, right? And that doesn't lead to the right answer, to your point. So I think my favorite thoughts about conflict are, I love Brené Brown's concept of the rumble, because the rumble really is get everything out on the table. We come to this from trust and openness and candor and find the right way through. And it might bring nobody's point. Yeah, I just love that.
Yeah. And I have my partner, Shrey, she's another amazing lady. We have a very heated discussion with respect. It's just like very passionate discussion. And we appreciate that, because we always come out with, as you say, we come out with a solution or a decision that really is a combination of an outcome of that discussion that is neither what I, propose or what she proposed. It's always like an optimized combo. And that's how we try to evaluate it. Nobody wins. Like, we want to create, you want to create an environment where differences of opinion can be respectfully, and as you say, in a candor way, discussed to lead us to the truth and the right and value that we're looking for.
Do you have any tips about how to help people manage that conflict, though? You know, if you have two people getting so heated in a boardroom, how do you calm them down? Or like, what is it? Everyone takes a breather and you come back in 5 minutes? Or are there certain phrases that are like a go-to for, okay, we got to level set this and take it back down a notch? Do you have any actionable thoughts around how people can not diffuse conflict, but maybe reframe it in the moment?
Yeah, so thank you for the question. I'm typically the person in the conflict, not the one who's diffusing the conflict, just to be like very honest here. So Shui is the one who typically, I think, reminding people that the goal is shared. Like that, she always says, like, the goal is shared and let's slow down. And because there's good ideas on both sides, let's slow down and, you know, write down the points from this side and the points from this side. And you feel like sometimes two people are saying they've done the same things, but they miss the beginning or the end. So I think like reminding people their goal is shared, but I'm typically one of the people that might be, you know, calm down, like, I'm getting better. And the older I get, I'm getting better.
That would be me too. I have a little bit of a fiery personality. Right. So it's like always helpful when people are like, all right, take it down a notch. But I like that. I'm going to embrace that.
It actually triggers me more when people say, oh, let's go calm down, like your readers. For me, it's like, my goal is shared. Let's have an action as an outcome of it. Let's write down or discuss the key points. I think with someone, maybe it's cultural because it's, I feel like, why are you telling me to calm? This is what comes to my mind. It's like, why are you telling me to calm down? Like, then it's like my mind, I get distracted versus, again, let's find the basically solution or what are the topic? What are the key points that you want to mention? What are the key points from the other side? And that, you know, make it more of an actionable. I also, when I realize that I'm getting like heated up, I like also try to diffuse it with healthy humor, but not to ridicule the moment or just, okay, we're getting ridiculous at this. Let's quickly try to get something out of it rather than stay in this loop.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing is being able to break the cycle of exactly what you said. You may be saying the exact same thing that someone else is saying, but you're just not hearing each other at that point. Exactly. So I like that though. Sit down and make the list. How do we get to the shared goals? Because it distracts everyone from their anger because then you have a task, right?
Yes. I just want to say that it's not cultural. There is a lot of psychology research showing that if you tell someone to calm down, it has the exact opposite effect. Anyone listening to this podcast, that is the takeaway. Do not tell people to calm down. Nobody likes it and no one's calming down. When you think about supporting people within your funds, you bring somebody in and now you want them to succeed. There's a monetary investment, and then there's also the personal investment. You believe in them and you want this drug, this therapeutic, whatever, to go to market. What are the things that you provide in terms of support? Who do you connect them with? A lot of these people don't have a lot of experience bringing a company or a product through to the market.
Yeah. Being in the industry for close to 15 years right now, you build a network in connection. And that's something in advice for anyone who's starting their career. Build genuine connection. And it's important that for me, network and connections are very important. So I've been really lucky to have a very strong network within the industry, whether it's drug development, manufacturing, supply chain, finance. And we actually have very strong advisory board supporting us, whether operationally or supporting some of our companies, the ex-chief medical officer of GlaxoSmith that had 26 drugs approved. So having someone like Ron on our team that we can like really bring him on, and some of the companies and entrepreneurs that don't have the same level of experience, we have ex-FDA people are part of our advisory board as well, and really help people navigate and be creative around FDA interaction. Also having, because I also did some business internationally, whether it's in Asia or Australia. And also opening up the potential for companies. And a lot of people are fearful of a global footprint or global partnership. And just, you know, giving them some guidance about the benefits and opportunities for having these global partnerships. I say we approach our investments in our companies with a private equity mindset, where we bring more than just capital. We bring value and expertise, whether to us, the team, or traditional advisory board or our larger network.
Allison probably thinks that I intentionally queue up a question every time that brings it back to networking, but I feel like every single guest talks about how important the network is. And it just is so true. We come back to it time and time again. And the nice thing is that science isn't done in a bubble. It doesn't have to be. And here we are to support each other.
It's impossible to do science or build a company or develop a product in a bubble. Like, you need the network. You need the different point of view. It is one of the most rewarding aspects of being an entrepreneur and building a company is having a genuine network that you can depend on, not only professionally. When I was working at my first startup, I had an advisor who was an executive in T-Mobile. She had multiple companies that she built and exited. You know, sometimes I would freak out. I was like, what should I wear? Instead of stressing out, then she would tell me what to wear. Okay. And I've never felt that this was an awkward question for me. Just build a network around you that can be friends or can, you know, be colleagues that you can depend on them and enjoy working with them as well.
So what's next for you? What do you want to achieve in the next 10 years?
I want to invest in companies that are building technologies that can help human health. And I would love it to be accessible globally and to truly have a humanitarian link for everyone. The other thing is I have a daughter, and part of my mission is to continue to equity and equality is for everyone is important, and providing opportunities for people. One thing that we do at the fund is also provide internship opportunities for students or newly grads that are from diverse backgrounds. So really try to be part of that, as a movement is very important for me. And I giving back to the future entrepreneurs. I had a lot of people that helped me. And it's just continue to give back.
What is your favorite book that you think everybody should read? Anything.
It's a book about the boats, boys.
The boys in the boat?
Boys in the boat, yeah. That is whatever. It just captures a lot of the human behavior, human emotions that apply to a lot of things. Importance of a team and importance of perseverance, commitment, focus. So I like it because it kind of captures a lot of the things that I believe in, and it's an inspiring story. And I lived in Seattle for a long time, so it was one of the first books that I read when I moved to the U.S.
Okay, I'm definitely going to read it. You're the second person who's recommended it, and I think there's also a movie out now. So
I didn't watch the movie. Yeah, but yes.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Lynn, where can people find you if they want to connect with you?
LinkedIn. I'm very responsive. The other thing that I would achieve in the next 10 years is try to respond to every email or LinkedIn message that people send.
Good luck with that. I feel like we're just getting more and more communication thrown at us. Feel like my next 10 years, I might just go off the grid entirely. Well, we'll link to your LinkedIn in our show notes, as well as your website and all of that, because I think people are going to want to connect with you, learn more, and follow your career. And I hope in the next 10 years, you or some of the companies you work with find a cure for Alzheimer's. That is what I'm holding out hope for.
Interesting. Someone called me yesterday saying the same thing. So
I'm
excited.
It's a worthwhile mission. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been fantastic. I think a lot of people are going to get great insights out of this. And you're probably going to have a little flood of people trying to connect with you on LinkedIn.
Thank you so much, guys. This was wonderful.
Building Biotechs is brought to you by Recruitomics Consulting. To find out more about Recruitomics Consulting and how our fractional talent management consulting services are helping biotech and life sciences companies grow more efficiently and retain employees, visit www.recruitomics.com. And then make sure to search for Building Biotechs, a podcast by Recruitomics, in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, or anywhere else podcasts are found. Make sure to click subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Recruitomics Consulting, thanks for listening.